Well, our conversation today is about how the military approaches other cultures and the thinking reintroduced in Iraq and Afghanistan of embedding social scientists with soldiers. In 2008, Paula Lloyd, a young anthropologist embedded with troops in Afghanistan, was killed when an Afghan man doused her with fuel and set her afire. A former Army Ranger working with Paula handcuffed the Afghan, then shot and killed him. Now, many anthropologists had long objected to joining forces with the military, but this was the worst outcome imaginable for the so-called human terrain teams and the military's plan to make troops more culturally conscious. Vanessa Ghazari tells Paula's story in her terrific new book, The Tender Soldier, A True Story of War and Sacrifice. But in it, she also tells the history of anthropology in war, from Lawrence of Arabia and Margaret Mead to Montgomery McFate, the child of San Francisco houseboat hippies who asked, why can't anthropologists study war, and then helped start the modern-day program. Vanessa joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
And remind us, Lawrence of Arabia, Margaret Mead, they did what?
Lawrence of Arabia, a very accomplished guy who had studied history and in the Middle East, walked across big chunks of that region and participated in an anthropological dig there before he became a military advisor. And Margaret Mead in this country and other anthropologists of her era, very involved in the U.S. government's planning during the run-up to and during World War II.
Lawrence of Arabia, Thomas Edward Lawrence, was seen as aiding an imperialist colonizer, although World War II anthropologists were seen as supporting a good war, and then came Vietnam. What happened in Vietnam that really ratcheted up this debate?
One thing is that the escalation of the war in Vietnam in the mid-60s coincided with a huge growth in anti-war protests. And a lot of those took place on college campuses. There were teach-ins. And so a number of social scientists, even some who had previously worked with the government, became leaders in these anti-war demonstrations. And there grew up this rift between particularly the field of anthropology and the U.S. defense establishment. Although it's important to note there is some complexity there. There are some anthropologists even now working with the government and the military, and the human terrain system is only one way in which they do that.
Well, and you explain why. And especially in this time that we're talking about, the question was, who are planning all these roadside bombs? We don't know. There's no front lines. We don't know who's who. So who can help us know? Well, social scientists. And give us more of a sense of why this was needed, what the military didn't understand about going into people's homes, about talking to women.
It's important to note that this is about gathering intelligence. Programs like the Human Terrain System are about getting smarter about who's doing the killing, as well as getting smarter about things like where to dig a well or where to build a school. So on one level, there are problems of cultural etiquette, like soldiers would go into the homes of Afghans or Iraqis. How should they behave when an Afghan offers you tea? You should accept it, because to not accept it can give offense, and this can create lots of problems for you. It may seem like a small thing to us, but very small things such as not taking off your shoes when you enter an Afghan home, it actually matters to the people there. These are practices that everybody lives by, and there are reasons for them. So this is on the level of not offending people unnecessarily. There's a whole other level of kind of information gathering that this particular program was designed to address, which is connected to that, which is that if the first thing you do is to not understand someone's language, not understand a person's customs, commit these breaches of etiquette, and then you begin to say, well, where are the Taliban? The likelihood is that that person's not going to take you seriously, not going to talk to you, not going to trust you. There are all these ways in which these two kinds of information gathering or cultural intelligence are related, cultural knowledge and cultural intelligence.
So it seemed like such a good idea. Why wouldn't we want the U.S. military to better understand the people that they're interacting with? But in 2007, the American Anthropological Association declared its opposition to the human terrain system. They felt that anthropologists were supposed to be morally and politically responsive to the people that they were observing, not to the military that might then kill some of those people when they discovered who's who. Into this picture comes Montgomery McFate. What a fascinating woman she is. Tell us a little more about her.
She's an anthropologist, trained as a cultural anthropologist, had a very interesting, chaotic childhood, grew up in a houseboat community near San Francisco, and sort of lived a wild life as a young person, but very, very smart, very good at school, and was really stabilized by her success in school. Did her undergraduate work at Berkeley and then went to Yale to get her PhD in cultural anthropology, but didn't stay in anthropology. She did do a dissertation for her PhD on the British and the IRA. So she was already thinking about issues around conflict and war, and also the relationship between anthropology and intelligence, which is something that is kind of off limits, at least in academic anthropology, to talk about. And she was really frustrated by that. She went to law school, and then she actually got married to an army captain and started to think really hard as she became more a part of this military world about how what she knew about anthropology could help a military that she thought was making all kinds of mistakes, particularly in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Again, incredibly well-intentioned, thinking maybe I could save lives of Afghans, Iraqis, and Americans if everybody better understood everybody else. But tell us more about, isn't all anthropology intelligence? The question is whether or not an anthropologist should actually work with the military, because they could certainly go take your book out of the library.
Well, that's something I think McFate would really agree with, that all anthropology in some way can at least be used for whatever purposes the military wants to put it to. And it has been used that way historically, as she was at pains to point out in lots of articles that she wrote during the time she was building up this program. But, you know, anthropologists would say what we do is very different. The reasons that we're gathering this information, we're not gathering this for operational reasons. And their research is often directed at asking and answering vastly different kinds of questions. So it's sort of a case of, can all anthropology be used for intelligence? Perhaps. But are anthropology and intelligence the same thing? Not exactly.
Well, and another thing is that anthropologists in the field, instead of in a book, can be misconstrued as military and can be killed, as Paula Lloyd was on one of the teams that Montgomery McFate created. Up next, Vanessa Gazzari will tell us Paula Lloyd's story. Vanessa's book is The Tender Soldier, A True Story of War and Sacrifice.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, offering a variety of insurance products, including auto, renters, boat, and motorcycle. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's Here and Now, and we're hearing today about the civilian anthropologist who worked with the military in Iraq and Afghanistan to try to bring more cultural consciousness to troops. But as we heard before the break, many anthropologists were worried that they would be seen as spies from the military or be killed. We reported on the death of anthropologist Paula Lloyd, a young Afghan man she was speaking with, doused her with fuel, set her on fire. Vanessa Gazzari tells her story in her new book, The Tender Soldier, A True Story of War and Sacrifice. Vanessa, Paula Lloyd, a bachelor's degree in anthropology, a master's in diplomacy and conflict resolution, experience in Afghanistan, because she joined the Army after graduating from Wellesley in 2002. Her reserve unit was called up, deployed to Kandahar. In many ways, she was just the person the military needed.
Paula Lloyd had an amazing background and amazing set of experiences that made her really perfect for this job. She, as you mentioned, had an undergraduate degree in anthropology. She had served as a soldier in Afghanistan and had worked in civil affairs there, which is the military reserve unit that does nation building when the military acknowledges doing that, which it does more and more. So she had a lot of experience working with people in southern Afghanistan and working specifically on aid and development related things with them through the military. She then spent several years working with NGOs and development organizations in Afghanistan. And one of the reasons that I wanted to write about her is that their team, which was the first to go into southern Afghanistan, the first human terrain team to work in that part of the country, which is the heartland of the Taliban, their team in some ways represented a best-case scenario, I think, for some of the kinds of experience and background of people you could get in a program like this. And yet, they still found themselves very quickly in the midst of some pretty terrible stuff.
Well, you're one of the few journalists who's been able to talk to the people behind the human terrain teams, the people that were on her team. You also retrace the team's steps, went to that village, went to that spot where she was doused, where her attacker was assassinated. And even you, it's still hard to put together the story of what happened, because this is exactly why the military wanted anthropologists. People will accuse others of being Taliban when they're not. Maybe they're just settling a score. You have people who are corrupt. It's as if everyone you spoke to, it's that old proverb, had their hand on a different part of the elephant. And it was very hard to figure out exactly what had happened and why.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And one of the things I really wanted to do in this book, and one of the reasons I wrote it the way I did, was I wanted to make the reader feel just how complicated and confusing that situation is, and to imagine being, you know, a soldier or an aid worker or a member of one of these teams trying to figure out what's really going on in this place. I mean, in one of the chapters in the book, I take the reader through a series of interviews in which a number of people tell contradictory stories about why that man attacked Paula Lloyd that day. Some readers might find that confusing, like, why did I put in all of these different stories and these different accounts that give different reasons for why he behaved the way he did? Well, I did it because that's at the very heart of why the military thought it needed these teams, and perhaps what people can contribute who don't come into a situation thinking like a soldier, but more come into it thinking like a reader or an interpreter of stories.
Well, in the end, it's just a terrible loss of just a shining human being, Paula Lloyd. Also, the members of her team that were involved in this day were in different ways destroyed. You tell their personal stories. But what's happened to the terrain teams? Because you tell anecdotes of seeing teams later that didn't have the people who were trained the way she was, and they're doing things like asking, why are we posting letters to communities? Why don't we just drop flyers in everybody's mailbox, when they don't even know that people in that community don't have a mailbox? So the sense that the reader gets is that the human terrain teams now don't even have the accomplished people that they once had.
Yeah, so the human terrain teams are really a mixed bag. They have had some people, very few, I would say, who are as qualified as Paula Lloyd, but they certainly have had people on the teams who know something about Afghanistan, who might have been to the country before, who might have some relevant experience, might even have language skills. Those are the better teams. I mean, I spent time with probably four or five different teams, often weeks at a time, and I talked with numerous other members of the program. And I was really shocked and saddened to find how few people had anything like that level of experience. I will say that I looked for the teams that had the best experience. I asked the program to send me to the best teams. And so what I write in the book, you know, appalling as some of that may be in terms of the lack of expertise, those were some of the teams that I was sent to by the program.
Well, you write towards the end of your book that the human terrain system was grown too fast. Though there were bright spots, in the end, it would prove less controversial for what it did than for its sheer incompetence. As you just said, it didn't have as many people, access to as many people who lived up to Paula Lloyd. There just weren't that many people with socio-cultural knowledge of Iraq and Afghanistan in the U.S., and many had already taken jobs in the defense industry. But it also sounds like incredibly well-intentioned. You meet people who still would say, I think we can make war better through combining social science and the military. What do you conclude?
I think there are a tremendous number of problems with the human terrain system as it is currently constructed, not the least of which is that it flies in the face of what anthropologists and other social scientists can do in terms of the ethical guidelines of their jobs. So there are ways to, I think, get these people to help the military be smarter. I just don't think those ways involve sending social scientists out into the field with soldiers. So I think this program was developed too quickly and without the right safeguards. The moment to learn about people in the places where we're fighting is not in the middle of a war. We really need to look at what we do in terms of military cultural knowledge and have some forethought and address this in a long-term way, because in the next conflict, which may already be upon us, I mean, look at what's happening in Syria, we're going to have exactly the same problems, and we're not going to have a good way to deal with them.
In other words, you're saying make it an ongoing part of the military, that we know more about people around the world just as a matter of course.
Yes, and that we develop the programs that work and get rid of the ones that don't. And I really think this is a good moment as we're winding down in Afghanistan for military and political leaders to take a look at the human terrain system and really ask themselves, is this the way we want to go forward? Look, we developed this thing in the middle of a war, so now we have a moment to reevaluate it and decide, do we want to keep this? Do we want to get rid of it? And what other kinds of programs can we develop to have long-term sustained cultural knowledge base within particularly our army, because we're going to need it.
That's Vanessa Ghazari. Her new book is The Tender Soldier, A True Story of War and Sacrifice, the story of the military's human terrain system. Vanessa, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Lumosity.com, dedicated to improving memory and attention with neuroscience-based games for the brain. At Lumosity.com. And Olin College of Engineering, working to educate the next generation of engineering innovators to solve the world's complex technical challenges. Olin.edu.